Why did Sony, the creator of the legendary Walkman, completely miss the digital music revolution while Apple swooped in with the iPod? How did UBS, Switzerland's most conservative bank with 3,000 risk managers, secretly accumulate $50 billion in toxic mortgage securities without anyone noticing until it was too late? These aren't stories of incompetence or conspiracy. They're examples of something far more insidious and common, the silo effect. Picture a family trapped in a burning Bronx apartment in 2011, killed not by the fire itself, but by illegally constructed walls. Multiple city agencies had received warnings, but never connected the dots, because each operated in its own isolated bubble. This tragedy reveals a paradox of modern life. We're more connected than ever through technology and globalization, yet our organizations, minds, and societies remain dangerously fragmented. Silos aren't inherently evil. We need specialized departments and expertise to manage complexity. But when these divisions become too rigid, information bottlenecks, innovation stalls, and catastrophic blind spots emerge. The question isn't whether we need structure, but whether we can see beyond the walls we've built. After the Bronx fire, former Iraq prosecutor Mike Flowers convinced Mayor Bloomberg to predict dangerous buildings through data. The 311 hotline failed. Manhattan residents called frequently while fires erupted in outer boroughs, where frightened immigrants stayed silent. Flowers sent analysts on ride-alongs with building inspectors as anthropologists. They discovered patterns. Buildings constructed before 1938, in poor neighborhoods, owned by people behind on mortgages, plagued by vermin complaints. By cross-referencing data from multiple city departments, information never combined before, their model became remarkably accurate. Inspectors found actual fire hazards 70% of the time versus their previous 13%. The solution wasn't more resources, it was demolishing walls between departments. Brett Goldstein's life shifted on September 11, 2001. Watching the attacks from Chicago Midway Airport, he realized his restaurant website work seemed trivial. He became a police officer. By 2009, Chicago's murder rate exceeded New York's despite its smaller population. Goldstein applied restaurant matching algorithms to crime patterns, analyzing data against weather and gang movements to create geospatial murder maps. FBI wiretaps confirmed criminals avoided data-driven police units. By 2011, Chicago's murder rate hit its lowest since the 1960s. As chief data officer, Goldstein created WindyGrid, breaking down data silos across departments. In November 1999, Sony's CEO unveiled three incompatible music players from different divisions at a Las Vegas trade show, organizational chaos disguised as strategy. Departments protecting their turf couldn't agree on a single approach. Within years, Apple's iPod dominated as Sony abandoned the digital music market. Sony hadn't always been dysfunctional. Founded in bomb-damaged Tokyo with 12 employees and $500, the company thrived on entrepreneurial collaboration. Their 1979 Walkman revolutionized music, but success bred bureaucracy. By the late 1990s, Sony had ballooned to 160,000 employees across specialized silos where managers hoarded ideas and avoided risks. Steve Jobs ran Apple as one cohesive and flexible company. iPod engineers collaborated freely across departments, creating an elegant solution. Organize music on computers, transfer to devices, and build iTunes to address piracy. By 2005, Sony's stock had collapsed. The company appointed Howard Stringer, a British-American outsider who didn't speak Japanese, precisely because he wasn't aligned with any internal tribe. Even his ambitious restructuring couldn't overcome entrenched resistance. As he admitted, "People would say yes to me, but nothing would happen." In March 2007, Swiss regulators asked UBS executives about their U.S. housing exposure. The response was confident. They'd insured against losses and even bet on falling prices. 6 months later, CEO Marcel Rohner revealed $10 billion in losses and $50 billion in secretly accumulated subprime mortgage securities, assets top management didn't know existed. Swiss taxpayers contributed 6 billion francs to rescue the bank. An independent investigation reached a chilling conclusion. There was no conspiracy. UBS leadership genuinely believed their bank was healthy, as did auditors and regulators. As one economics professor noted, the bank's conservative image corresponded fully with the picture that the bank had of itself. The most terrifying aspect wasn't deception, it was collective self-delusion. The problem was fragmentation. Though UBS employed 3,000 risk officers, they worked in isolated departments with minimal communication. When regulators visited London, risk officers highlighted short positions against housing, but omitted massive long positions held by the New York office. Bankers maintained rigid mental categories. AAA assets were completely different from BBA assets, despite obvious contradictions. In November 2008, Queen Elizabeth II asked economists, "Why did nobody see the crisis coming?" The answer? While people were doing their jobs, nobody could see the complete picture. Economics had become obsessed with complex mathematical models and increasingly siloed from other social sciences. In December 2006, Paul Tucker noted that while most indicators suggested stability, broad money was expanding alarmingly, growth coming from other financial corporations, essentially a miscellaneous category for unclassifiable financial entities. The breakthrough came in August 2007 when Paul McCulley declared, "The real issue going on right now is a run on the shadow banking system." This phrase instantly gave economists a mental framework for understanding the crisis. Researchers at the New York Fed began mapping this shadow system, creating a diagram so vast it required a poster several feet wide, physically demonstrating that shadow banks weren't footnotes but central pillars of finance. In 2009, prominent economists finally answered the Queen's question. The failure was principally a failure of the collective imagination of many bright people to understand the risks to the system as a whole. When Jocelyn Goldfein joined Facebook in 2010, she accidentally crashed the email system while deploying a bug tracking program prematurely. Instead of territorial backlash, she found collaboration. No one questioned her right to work across team boundaries. In 2008, Facebook's leadership worried about surpassing 150 engineers, Dunbar's number, where social cohesion typically breaks down. They implemented countermeasures. Bootcamp gave new engineers 6 weeks working across the entire code base before choosing teams, building organization-wide networks. Zuckerberg redesigned the campus, removing walls, installing glass meeting rooms, and positioning his own glass-walled office centrally, encouraging constant movement and random collisions. Facebook's platform enabled horizontal communication rather than rigid hierarchies. Managers required real names when discussing colleagues, never dehumanizing labels. Hackathons forced engineers to collaborate outside normal teams, forging common identity. These structural choices created an organization where information flowed freely and collaboration trumped territorial protection, proving rapid growth didn't require inevitable fragmentation. Marcel Proust wrote that the real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. Mike Flowers exemplified this, connecting six separate bureaucratic systems handling 911 calls dramatically improved emergency response simply by bringing data together and thinking differently. To challenge classification systems, we must become insider-outsiders who view our environments with fresh perspective through crossing borders, changing careers, or seeing through others' eyes. The challenge is making time for these perspective-shifting activities in a world obsessed with efficiency. Modern education and career paths push specialization, creating technical experts rather than generalists. Institutions eliminate waste, making it difficult to justify activities without immediate results, like cross-department conversations or creating cultural translators. But rigid streamlining ultimately makes our world less effective. Specialized silos may seem efficient, but create fragmented systems with hidden risks. When Cleveland Clinic's CEO learned families avoided his hospital due to lack of empathy, he reorganized around body systems rather than specialties, forcing collaboration. By 2013, the hospital topped patient satisfaction rankings while reducing costs, proving that breaking silos transforms outcomes. We face a choice: be mastered by our divisions or master them by questioning our classifications. The real danger isn't the walls we build, it's forgetting they exist. Success depends on seeing beyond rigid categories and connecting fragmented information. The future belongs to those who bridge divides, translate between tribes, and maintain peripheral vision that prevents catastrophic blind spots.